following in English is 24A4. We concluded last week a long discussion responsive to a Mishnah, and this week we begin with a quotation from a Mishnah which we saw many pages ago, and I will first look at that Mishnah with you. 24A4, just take the little piece of the Mishnah that's quoted in the Gemara. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Mi Shechara Beit HaMikdash Atzeret Keshabbat. From the time that the temple was destroyed, Atzeret is treated like Shabbat. Atzeret is treated like Shabbat. Now, I'd like to read this Mishnah in its entirety, so that those of you who recall it from last year, I don't think we read it this year, will remember it, and in order to be able to put into context what's going to follow, we need to focus on the entire Mishnah. You will find it on 19A2. Page 19A2, in the above the line, starting about a little over a third of the way down the page, we are discussing here in that Mishnah the subject of what cancels what, and whether the Sabbath cancels mourning, whether Yom Tov cancels mourning. And let's take a look there. Mipnesha Amru, this is the last piece of Mishnah that we discussed, just prior to where we are now in our chapter. Shabbat Ola Ve'ena Masekhet. Shabbat counts in the count of the 7 days of Shiva, Ve'ena Masekhet, but it doesn't interrupt the Shiva. Regalim Masikim Ve'inanolim. The regel, or regels, the pilgrimage festivals, cut off the Shiva, the Einan Olin, and do not count. They cut off the Shiva and they do not count. Now, without going into what that actually means, it's clear that there's a difference between the Sabbath and the regalim. And at least in this statement, regalim, whatever it is that they do, they cut short and are not included, it's regalim in plural. How many regalim are there? Shalosh regalim. There are shalosh regalim. They are firstly Pesach, then Sukkot, Pesach, then Shavuot, and then Sukkot. Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Because the beginning of the year is Chodesh Nisan. Okay? Even though you think that it's Rosh Hashanah.
It's Tishrei.
Okay? Tishrei is not. Tishrei is the seventh month. Okay? Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the seventh month. The first month is Nisan. Nisan. That's why I started with Pesach. Okay? So, anyway, Shabbat is on the one side, Shabbat Ola Ve'ena Masekhet, and the Regalim are in a different position. They're Mafsikim Ve'ena Nolim. They interrupt, they cut short the counting of Shiva, and are not included. Now, Rabbi Eliezer comes and provides a dissent. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Mi Shacharav Bet Amigdash. Since the temple, from the time that the temple was destroyed, Atzeret Keshabbat. Shavuot is like a Shabbat. Now, first of all, the language here. Atzeret is Shavuot. Keep that in mind. You know what Atzeret means?
Holding back.
That's pretty good, holding back. Or when you, right, if you're on an Israeli bus and you want to get off and you push the button, what does it say?
Atzor.
Atzor. That's all. That's all. Which means stop. Okay? That means stop. So, atzeret means something like stop or holding up or something like that. Okay? Now, take the one that you know very well. There's a holiday called Shmini Atzeret. Okay? The eighth day of what? It's interesting if you think, well, you remember what you learned from the Silverman Prayer Book years ago? Or you, none of you remember the Silverman Prayer Book anymore? The old conservative prayer book, what was Shemini Atzeret had a name? There you go. Good for you. It was the eighth day of solemn assembly. The eighth day of solemn assembly. That's what it was in the Silverman Prayer Book. Now, of course, Shmini is eighth day. Solemn is not there at all. No. I grew up as a kid, so it's the eighth day of solemn. Then I learned Hebrew. I just couldn't figure out. Well, I didn't know Hebrew. I didn't know English. I couldn't. I didn't know what was wrong. So there's no solemn there. Assembly, atzeret, could be. Atzeret could be an assembly. Could be an
assembly.
I was going to say, if you have an assembly in school, or you have an assembly, it's called an atzeret.
Festive gathering.
Okay, it's a gathering. It's a gathering. Now, it could be that it all comes from the same idea. It's a gathering together, which is, let's say, in terms of water, in terms of energy, is an end point. Right? If you've got a water flowing down the hill and you've got a place to gather it, in a way, there's an atzeret, because it stops there and also gathers there. That's the imagery that's behind it. Okay? The question is, why is atzeret Shavuot?
It stops the 50 days. It stops the
two different ideas. You like it? You changed your mind already. You like it. Okay. So say it again.
It's stopping the counting.
It's stopping the counting. And that's a very good insight. It's the stopping of the counting. You started counting on the second day of Pesach. And when do you stop?
Shavuot.
On Shavuot. Okay, you stop then. So one sense of that is stopping. Another sense is the gathering together, the assembly, the collective assembly, as it were. It is as if the energy of Pesach, energy of liberation, finally all that energy is gathered into its final place, which is Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Right? So Atzeret means that Shavuot has, in effect, relative meaning vis-a-vis Pesach, as we know it does in terms even of its date. It has no absolute date, it only has a relative date vis-a-vis Pesach. Therefore, the name of Shavuot is Atzeret in the Talmud. When the Talmud uses the terminology Chad, as it will occasionally, that refers to only one of the Shalosh Regalim, Sukkot. Sukkot is Chag. Atzeret is not Shmini Atzeret. Atzeret is Shavuot. Okay? Atzeret is Shavuot. So that's what we have. So, back to the text. Mishachar Bet HaMikdash Atzeret KeShabbat. Once the temple is destroyed, Atzeret is treated like the Sabbath. That is to say, as we've just learned right up above, the sages have said, Shabbat olav ve'eino masechet. Shabbat counts in the counting, and it doesn't cut off. Now he is saying that after the destruction of the temple, Shavuot is treated the same way. Shavuot is treated the same way. Why? What's the difference between Shavuot, Sukkot, and Pesach?
The length of the holiday.
Shavuot in the Torah and in the land of Israel is one day long. You have to remember that. That's my classic question, by the way, to ask Hebrew school kids. And I want to see whether they learned anything. Come into the class with 12-year-olds and I say, okay, how many days is Shavuot? I say, who votes for 7? Most of them are irrelevant. So 8. All the rest vote for 8. I said, why 7? Why 8? And they said, 7 in Israel, 8 outside of the land. Okay. They're wrong. Shavuot is one day. It's one day in the land of Israel, outside of the land of Israel, 2 days. Of course, Rabbi Eliezer is talking about the land of Israel. He is speaking post the destruction of the temple. There is simply one day, and as far as days go, it's therefore qualitatively, because it's quantitatively absolutely different from the other regalim, it therefore, ipso facto, becomes qualitatively different. What is it like? It's like the Sabbath. The Sabbath is one day, that's one day. But there's another very fundamental difference. And it's very fundamental to the notion of why it is that the regal is masik, and why Shavuot is not masik. Masik meaning it cuts off for counting. Take a look at the English comment here, number 19. I want to read that with you. It's a thorough, very good comment, number 19. According to Rabbi Eliezer, the reason for the distinction between the Sabbath and the festivals is as follows. By rights, the festivals too should not have interfered with the course of Shiva. So he says, logically, you might have started out with the assumption that Shabbat and the festivals are exactly alike, right? Shiva could continue through a festival, as it does through the Sabbath, with the days of the festival counting toward the 7 days of Shiva. In theory, it could be like that. Could be like that. That's what he would say. However, the restrictions of Shiva would certainly not be observed on the festival, since that would conflict with the mitzvah of rejoicing on the festival. So that we know. Like the festival has a mitzvah of rejoicing. So indeed, it could be that it would count, that in fact the days would count, whatever that means, the days would count, but you wouldn't be able to observe the laws of Shiva because it's just contrary to the very idea of festival, which is rejoicing. However, inasmuch as Pesach and Sukkot both last for at least 7 days, were they to count toward the 7 days of Shiva, there would never be any days of Shiva left to observe after the festival. Get that again. Let's read that again. Inasmuch as Pesach and Sukkot both last for at least 7 days, right, fast for 8 days, were they to count toward the 7 days of Shiva, there would never be any days of Shiva left to observe after the festival. Therefore, assuming that you began your Shiva before, if you begin the Shiva before and you were to count the festival, there's no way that you could count the Shiva after the festival. So you know what? Ipso facto, what happens when the festival comes? It's Mafsik. It's Mafsik. It automatically ends up canceling the whole thing.
Postpone.
You could say it would postpone it. But if we say it's to be treated like the Sabbath, and you were to count like the Sabbath, then in effect, it cuts it off anyway. Okay? Because that's what the note says. The Rabbi Eliezer is treating it. He's starting out assuming that it should be treated, that the festival should be treated just like the Sabbath. The reality is, though, because of the mitzvah of Simcha on the festival, there would never be a time that you would observe Shiva afterwards. In effect, what happens is that because of the 7 day length of the festival, it automatically cuts it off. And that's essentially why it's mafsik. It's not mafsik because of any abstract principle of hafsaka. It's mafsik because of a practical reason, that it has 7 days. Right? Therefore, since the occurrence of a festival will in any case interrupt the ordinary observance of Shiva, the rabbis legislated either the festival cancels Shiva altogether, which is what we normally do, because if you're starting your observance before, it's going to in effect cancel. And you might as well enter the festival saying, Shiva's over, put the Shiva behind me. And we learned the last few times, we were talking about Devarim Shabitzina, our private things, which in effect are observed on the Sabbath. And in a way, we're removing from that, Abel now have the possibility, because the festival is different, the festival is an actual mitzvah simcha, so since he can't really observe the public side of Shiva anyway, we're giving you the opportunity, also we're saying you don't observe the private side. Okay? Therefore, since the occurrence of the festival will in any case interrupt the ordinary observance of Shiva, the rabbis legislated either that the festival cancel Shiva altogether, where Shiva began 3 days before the festival. That was the Gemara here, and the Mishnah here. It's not, remember, those of you who were here last year will remember that the law in the Mishnah was that you have to observe 3 days of Shiva before, then the festival can be mafsik. We learned when we discovered, when we read that Gemara changes the law, and it's one day or even 1 hour or 1 minute. Okay? Or that the count of 7 days be suspended during the festival and resumed after the festival. That could, in theory, happen. Because, in effect, you can't really observe it on the festival. So, in theory, you could resume it after the festival, where Shiva began fewer than 3 days before the festival, or where burial took place on the festival itself. Which is what we do. If a burial takes place on a festival, let's say somebody dies in the middle of a Pesach. Okay, you don't start counting Shiva until it's over. Okay, you don't, even though the burial is on the holiday, you don't start counting Shiva until it's over. But
what
in the case,
in the meantime?
What?
What do you do in the meantime?
Whatever you want to do. But it's not Shiva. You don't have to observe any of the laws of Shiva because it's a festival.
About the positive commandment.
It doesn't matter. You've already buried the dead. The suspension of the positive commandments was only before the burial. Burial has taken place, and it's sort of in an in-between time when it is the festival, but you're not observing Shiva. But in the case of the Sabbath, where this consideration does not apply, the 7 days of Shiva are counted right through the Sabbath. Okay, so that we know. That's what the Mishnah had said. Now, here's the key thing. As for Shavuot, although it lasts for only 1 day, it is still reckoned a 7-day festival, because the law is that if someone neglected on Shavuot to bring the requisite festival sacrifices which every Jewish male must offer on a festival, he may continue to offer them until 7 days have passed. Oh, so this is the key thing that you have to know. When you come to the temple, you come to the temple. And not the shul, the temple in Yerushalayim. Okay, you're coming to the temple in Yerushalayim. You're coming for Pesach. You got to come. What are you going to bring when you come to Pesach? Your Seder plate. What does it have on it that reminds you of what you would bring? It has a shank bone, which is for what? For the Korban Pesach, the Paschal sacrifice. But that's not all. What else does it have? It has a roasted egg. Why is a roasted egg there? Don't tell me because it's a springtime with fertility. Why is it there? A Korban Chagiga. Korban Chagiga. If you came to the temple, you are required to bring a festal offering, a shlamim that's called a Chagiga because it's a shlamim. You know when you bring a shlamim? Shlamim is so that you can just enjoy yourself. You enjoy yourself, your family comes, you invite some people, you have a party, you have big meals, that's the shlamim. So there is a requisite korban shlamim that you have to bring. And so you come to Pesach, and Pesach is actually an issue because of when you bring the chagiga, since you only have to bring a korban Pesach. There's actually an issue in the laws of Pesach. But let's just put that aside. The truth is Pesach is 7 days long. And if you're coming to the temple, you're in the land of Israel. So 7 days long. So let's say you don't bring it on the first day. What could you do? You bring it on the second day. If you don't bring it on the second day, you bring it on the third day. And on the fourth day, fifth day. How many days do you have? You have 7 possible days. 7 possible days to do this. And the truth is, you probably wouldn't bring it at the beginning anyway. Because you're eating the Korban Pesach first. The Korban Pesach won't last that long. It has to last for the Seder. And you're not even allowed to leave anything over from the Korban Pesach. Remember it says. Okay. So this next thing is to get you through for as long as you want to stay there. Get more food. Yeah, more food. You have another offering that you're bringing. And keep in mind that that's the principal way that you get meat to eat. Most people wouldn't eat meat. You get meat by bringing it to the temple. Some of the parts are sacrificed in the altar, but most of it is so you can eat it. Yeah, the whole thing is so you can eat it. So you have 7 days to do that. Sukkot, how many days do you have to do that? 7 days. Sukkot is 7 days long. The key thing is Shavuot. You get used to a certain rhythm of bringing that sacrifice. You make the trip from the Galilee all the way to Yerushalayim, you're not going to get to the temple and turn around and go home. At least you don't want to. You want to stay a while. Enjoy yourself. Have some celebratory meals. But Shavuot is one day. Shavuot is so fast, if you blink your eyes, it's over. We think it's 2 days. It is 2 days for us. Israel, one day, very fast. You don't get involved, it's finished. Sorry, it's finished. So, in light of that, what happens with the Chagiga? You forget to bring the Chagiga. Or you're too busy. Or you didn't bring a Chagiga from abroad. You wanted to buy one in Yerushalayim. The line was too long. Right? You were tired. So what do? The truth is, as far as the law goes, you also have 7 days. There are six more days of Tashlumin.
Why don't they make the holidays for 7 days?
Because the Torah says it's one day. What can I do? You have to ask God that. Doesn't the Torah? You have to just take it the way it is. But the rabbis figure out all these other issues, like what happens if you forget. The Torah doesn't say that. The rabbis say that. So if you forget, or you're on the line, you're tired, or whatever it is, you have a total of 7 days. Why? Because you always have 7 days. You have 7 days for each of the other two. You have 7 days for this one, too. So since that was the case during the time of the temple, in fact, Shavuot was treated as the other holidays. It was treated as a seven-day holiday from the perspective of other aspects of the law. Because if you were waiting to bring your Chagiga, for you it was still Simcha. The whole purpose of bringing the Chagiga is Simcha. Simcha is contrary to the laws of mourning. Right? So since in theory it could last for 7 days, Shavuot was treated as if it were 7 days, even though it was one day. Oh, fine. So now we see why, logically, to begin with, Pesach and the Sukkot logically would cut off mourning. No way that you could do it otherwise. We see now why Shavuot is brought into this picture as well, because it has these tashlumim, the way of extending the sacrifices for a total of 7 days, which means that it's then treated the same as the other two festivals.
Hmm. However, the korban plays a role here.
What happens after the temple is destroyed? After the temple is destroyed, you can't bring sacrifices anymore. Therefore, Rabbi Eliezer says, Mishachar Beit HaMikdash, once the temple has been destroyed, Shavuot is to be treated like Shabbat. Well, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. When you think about it, it's a very logical kind of idea. Because the only reason to have thought about it otherwise had to do with, number one, it being one of the regalim, the fact that the regalim, you went to Jerusalem, you had to bring the sacrifice, so you can't do that anymore. And it, in essence, is only one day. So the very thing that got us started to cancel the mourning was the fact that it was 7 days. We then brought Shavuot into it, but after the temple's destroyed, there's no reason to bring Shavuot into it anymore. Okay, and that's the issue that Rabbi Eliezer is responding to. And therefore he says, Mishachara Beit HaMikdash Atzeret Kashabbat. Once the temple has been destroyed, Shavuot, as far as the laws of mourning goes, is to be treated like Shabbat. Rabban Gamliel disagrees, and he says, Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'regalim. He says that not only, because realize once we've had this whole discussion about Shavuot, you could say to me, oh, you forgot something. What about Rosh Hashanah? What about Rosh Hashanah? Does Rosh Hashanah treat it like a regal? That is to say that it's mafsik? Well, why not? But there's a reason why not. Because on Rosh Hashanah, you know what? You don't bring a chagiga on Rosh Hashanah. You don't bring a chagiga on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah does not have that celebratory aspect to it that the other festivals have.
You don't have to go to Jerusalem for Rosh Hashanah.
And that's exactly right. It's not a pilgrimage festival. You don't have to bring the chagiga. Right? Rosh Hashanah is different. I wanted to just add the if Rosh Hashanah does not have that aspect of the joy, the obligatory joyful celebration in Jerusalem, that is, I believe, you could tell me, I heard it here first, I believe that that's why we don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? If you notice, it's very odd. You don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah. We have a rabbinic reason why that is said. The reason that's usually given is because how could we be singing when we're standing in judgment? So that's a good idea. That's not a bad idea. But I don't think that's why. I think it goes back to the fact that you have no chagiga. That it's essentially utterly different from the pilgrimage festivals. Right? It is. It's done at home. It's not done necessarily in the temple. You don't have this built-in idea of the celebratory meal. It's Yom Teruah. That's all the Torah says. Yom Teruah Yelachem. It shall be a day of the blasting of we don't even know what, but the blasting of something, Yom Teruah. Eventually happens to, we have to learn that it means a shofar, but it doesn't always mean shofar Yom Teruah. As a matter of fact, it's more likely that it means trumpets. Because when it's Yom Teruah is used, when Teruah is used in the book of Leviticus, it always refers to Chatzot Zrat, trumpets, not shofar. Mm-hmm.
Question. Do we know when Hallel was sung in the temple? Do we know the sequence of events? What was happening?
Yes, we actually do know. I don't remember, but we know when Hallel was sung. The Gemara does tell you that. There are brachot that give you all of the whole variety of psalms. I shouldn't say for sure Hallel. I'm not sure that that's true for Hallel. No, I take it back, because it does give you all the psalms said for the different holidays. That there is a beraita in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, so at the end of Rosh Hashanah on that. Don't think that beraita says anything about the Hallel, though. The recitation of Hallel on the holidays, but I don't remember for sure.
But we know, you're saying, when the Tehillim were being sung, we know what actions were being performed at the time.
Yes, that we know. That the Baraita tells you very much in detail exactly what was done. Correct.
So, somebody dies the day before one of the festivals. Bury them. It's one day of Shiva and that's it.
Could be 1 minute of Shiva.
And you don't resume afterwards.
No resumption afterwards. No resumption afterwards. That's the law. Okay?
Isn't Hallel said on Rosh Chodesh?
Said on Rosh Chodesh, correct.
And isn't that kind of a mini Day of Atonement
somehow? Somehow, because it does say you have to bring a chatat on Rosh Chodesh. It says, Seyel a chatat on Rosh Chodesh. Very, very good. It's also that. But Rosh Chodesh is sort of in between. It's got both things.
Mm-hmm.
Got both things to it. Okay? Okay. So, let's just finish with the Chachamim now. Rosh Hashanah v'Yom HaKippurim k'regalim. So Rabban Gamliel says that they should be treated as regalim, namely that they are mafsik and they don't count. Now, again, that doesn't stand necessarily to reason, because they're not even like Shavuot. They don't have a chagiga that would be brought. There's no sacrifice that's brought to be enjoyed. But and nonetheless, that's what Rabban Gamliel says. The Chachamim omrim lo kedivrei zeh v'lo kedivrei zeh. Sages say, this one's wrong and that one's wrong also. Okay? Instead, they say, Ela atzeret kiregalim. They say that atzeret, Shavuot, is treated like a festival. Rosh Hashanah v'yom kippurim k'shabbat. And they say Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are to be treated like Shabbat. Why? Because there's no Chagiga. There's no Chagiga there. And they would say even after the destruction of the temple, they disagree with Rabbi Eliezer. They said, once you set it up this way, we want to keep it that way forever, even if there is no temple. But Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are different. So they say Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah are to be treated like Shabbat. Before you take this too seriously, that's not the law. That is not the law. The law is that they are like regalim. And if Rosh Hashanah comes, cuts everything off. Yom Kippur cuts everything off. Okay? That's important, will become important in my early reads today.
Yes. I don't want to jump ahead, but what does this mean in regard to the 30 day?
You're jumping ahead. You'll see. Okay. I'll tell you in shorthand. It means the same thing that it's meant for Shiva. Because if any of the Shloshim has been observed before, then it stops the Shloshim. If none of the Shloshim has been observed before, it does not stop it. So let's say you had the example you gave me. You had a burial the day before the regal. Okay? So the regal stops Shiva. It doesn't stop Shloshim, because you had no Shloshim. So you start counting then. The day of your burial is day one. And then we'll see the way that you count for the Shloshim. It won't be so simple the way it's counted for Shloshim, but it will count in the Shloshim. Okay?
The rejection of the argument of Rabbi Eliezer and of Rabbi Gamliel by the Chachamim is based on what, their dislike of too much logic
I think it's based on their assumption that the logic used by Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer was based on the Chagiga being brought. That was the source of the logic. And there is no Chagiga brought on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur. If there is no Chagiga brought, there is no reason to treat them any differently, because they're only one day. Alright? Even Rabbi Eliezer would have said, if Shavuot had been 7 days, everything would be different. But it's not 7 days, it's only one day. It's only after the temple. It's back to one day. While you have the temple, it's treated as 7 days. Once you don't have a temple, it's treated as one day.
Right? It says that the argument of Rabbi Gamliel comes from a different direction than the argument of Rabbi Eliezer, which is, and I think we discussed this, if Shabbat canceled Shiva, you'd never have a full 7 day of Shiva, because Shabbat comes every week.
Correct. Correct, that is true.
In the case of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they only come once a year.
Correct, that's all that is true. That is also true.
So the arguments are very well thought out and
correct.
Very well structured.
Correct.
It's almost as if the Chachamim said, you know what, there's too much calculation for us.
Possibly. I think each of these points of view is logical.
Very.
I mean, each point of view, when you see what's behind it, each point of view has something to recommend it. Which is why, of course, none of them are accepted. When it comes down to it, it's a compromise that actually becomes the law, because there is something to be said for each of these points of view. Okay? Very good. Now, back to where we started. Okay. We're back on 24A4. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Mi Shecharav Beit HaMikdash Atzeret KeShabbat. Rabbi Eliezer says, once the temple was destroyed, Shavuot is like Shabbat. Rabbi Gamliel says, even Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are like the festivals. The sages say differently from either opinion, rather Shavuot is like the festivals, and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are like the Shabbat. The Gemara cites a rule. Amar Rav Gidl Bar Menashe, Amar Shmuel, Halacha Karaban Gamliel. So he says that the law is according to Rabban Gamliel. So Rabban Gamliel says, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are like the festivals. Well, that's true. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are like the festivals. Okay. Shavuot, of course, is treated like a festival too. Rama Gamliel didn't say that, but anyway, as far as Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur goes, it's correct. The Ike de Matnei La Darav Gidol Bamenasha Aha. And there are those who teach this decision of Rav Gidol Bar Menashe was taught in relation to something else. And now we're going to go into a long baraita. Some of this baraita will be directly relevant to the question that we're raising. Most of it is not, as it's not unusual. But you'll see that this baraita is a very interesting baraita, and as frequently happens in the Talmud, it has its own life. And it will take over because it raises some issues that have not yet been raised. That's it. Kol Shloshim Yom Tinok Yotzei Echek. During 30 days, an infant is taken to the cemetery in the bosom. Now, we will try to get through most of this, then we'll explain it. V'nikbar b'isha achat u'shnei anashim, and is buried by one woman and two men. Aval lo b'ish echad u'shtei nashim, but not by one man and two women. Abba Shaul omer af b'ish echad u'shtei nashim. He disagrees and he says that infant can be buried by one man and two women. And they do not stand because of this in the row to console the mourners. And as a result of this, they do not say the blessing for mourners and the consolation words that are said to mourners. Then Shloshim Yotzei Bidaluskama. A 30-day-old, however, is taken out to the burial, not v'chek, not carried just in the bosom, but in a box. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo deluskama hanitelet bekatef, not a box that is carried on the shoulder, ela hanitelet ba'agapayim, but one that is carried in the arms. V'omdim alav b'shura, and they stand in the row. V'omrim, Allah birkat avelim v'tanchumei avelim, and they say for him the blessing of the mourners and the consolation to mourners. Then shneimasar chodesh yotzei b'mita, a 12-month-old is taken out on a bier. Rabbi Akiva Omer hu ben shana va'averav kven shtayim. If he is a year old, but his body is like a 2-year old, hu ben shtayim, or he's 2 years old and his body is like 1 year old, yotzei b'mita, he is taken out on a bier. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, vayotzei b'mita rabim matzivim alav. When a child is taken out on a bier, the public grieves over him. When he is not taken out in the bier, the public do not grieve over him. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer, Nikar l'rabim, rabim mispasim bo. If he was known to the public, then the public involves itself with him. Eino nikar l'rabim, eino rabim mispasim bo. If he was not known to the public does not busy itself with him. Keeps going. I'm going to read to the end and we'll start all up again. Ma hende hesped. What is the law with regard to these people as far as eulogizing them? Rabbi Meir b'shem Rabbi Yishmael Omer. Rabbi Meir in the same of Rabbi Yishmael says, Aniyim b'nei shalosh, ashirim b'nei chamesh. Poor people at 3 years old. Rich people at 5 years old. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mishmo, Rabbi Yehuda says in his name, Aniyim b'nei chamesh, ashirim b'nei shesh. Poor people the age of 5, rich people the age of 6. Uvenezekenim kivnei aniyim. And children of old people are treated like the children of poor people. Amar Rav Gidl bar Menashe Amarav. Said Rav Gidl bar Menashe, said Rav. Okay, here we are back to where we started. We got into this paraita. You saw Rav Gidl bar Menashe. Remember him? He was just up at the beginning. Amar Rav, Halacha ka Rabbi Yehoshua.
Yehuda.
Halacha ka Rabbi Yehuda, Shamar Mishul Rabbi Yishmael. The halacha goes according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, said in the name of Rabbi Yishmael. Okay.
Funny name for a rabbi.
What? Which name?
Yishmael.
There are plenty. There are plenty. Okay. Let's go back to the beginning of this paragraph. Sorry.
Where are all these distinctions debated?
Let's see what they're talking about first, okay? What the Gemara is discussing here are the laws of mourning vis-a-vis infants. This is a very interesting area of law about which a lot is being written today, and I think it's interesting to see some of the issues that are involved here. If an infant dies during the first 30 days after birth, of course you have to bury the infant, naturally. But according to the law, there is no mourning. That is the issue here.
It's not 3 months?
No, it's 1 month. 1 month. There is a 1 month period. Although the Gemara does not discuss it here, during the first month, the child is considered lav bar kaima, or safek bar kaima is a better way to put it, that it is of doubtful viability. Because the child is considered doubtful viability, it is not treated in all respects, if God forbid there is a death, is not treated as a person who is of certain viability. What is the definition of viability? 1 month. 1 month. Now, undoubtedly, this reflects a medical reality. Without saying whether it continues to reflect a medical reality, I would just raise for your thought that it does create a way of thinking about birth, which is vastly different from the way we are used to thinking about birth. As a matter of fact, I would say most, not all, but most young women who are pregnant today assume the viability of the child. Most couples assume that viability. And ever so many in the current parlance, for example, if you ask what they saw in the sonogram, they will say, "We saw the baby. We saw the baby on the sonogram." The truth is that as far as the classical language goes, they didn't see the baby on the sonogram. They saw the fetus on the sonogram. That has tremendous ramifications in the laws of abortion. Because you cannot kill a baby. You might be able to say that there are grounds for aborting a fetus. But the language is not unimportant here, because we actually have language that reflects, or might reflect, certain areas of ethical reality. It might not. For example, the Catholic Church will say it does not, because there is the same level of sanctity to the unborn as to the born. That's the argument that you hear from the church.
Even in
okay. I want to sensitize you to the fact that this kind of issue, what's implied here, even though it's of course coming out of the pre-modern medical reality, nonetheless, these are issues that we always are living with, even if the details change. Take the idea of infant viability, of neonatal viability.
Do they still even use that word? Anyway?
What? Neonatal viability?
Viability.
I don't know. Barry, did I use it?
Sure. Viability, wow.
Because if you have, we had a few years ago a rash of these cases. I don't know the extent, you don't hear about them so much, so I don't know whether they are there or not. But the cases of the neonates that are born severely damaged, with severe medical problems.
Premature.
Or, you know, it could be from premature birth, or it could be whatever. Now, one of the increases the likelihood, of course, the earlier the birth is. At that point, the question of modern medical ethics was for a long time, I don't know that it's still being debated today, was, do you have to use all means, all medical means, or is it permissible to allow that infant to die? Is that somehow different from the normal case? Or is the reality of birth so absolute that no intermediate possibilities there? What am I telling you here reading in the Gemara? I'm reading in the Gemara that, in fact, it's interesting that there are some intermediate possibilities. I don't know whether to apply them to this case, because, in fact, they're not directly applied to this case at all here. But you can see that the assumption is, who is mourning? The mourners are, in fact, the parents are mourning, right? When we are talking about mourning for the death of an infant, we are talking principally about the mourning of the parents for the death of the infant. In this case, you can see that the parents are not mourning for that death, because the parents are expecting a possibility of death. And until 30 days go by, the parent is not relating to the infant as if the infant is going to live.
The birth is not the key.
So at least some aspect of it. And indeed, much of this has to do with the development of a relationship. If you relate to what you have as perhaps being there tomorrow, perhaps not being there tomorrow, if it's a doubtful, potentially doubtful viability, you relate to it one way. If people relate as a result of the sonogram to the certain viability of the fetus, they develop a powerful relationship with that fetus. This is the thing we see all the time today. And God forbid something happens, and it's a major calamity. And part of the reason for the major calamity is that, in fact, the relationship has developed. And the relationship has developed partly as a result of the assumption of viability. Partly. That's not the only thing. Part of it is that you're actually seeing it. There's a level of interaction with it, certainly in a mental level. Physically, too.
Is this related at all to the portion we read in, I forget whether it's in Tazria or in Sora, about the woman being tamei, the new mother, for a certain period after the birth?
I don't think so directly. I mean, yes, we're talking about birth, so in that way, yes. But I don't think that it's the viability, the question of viability of the infant, of the neonate here, that's relevant as far as the issues of Tuman Torah go. It's rather the blood, I think, that's involved in the birth process. That's the key feature. Or it is the birth. It is birthing itself that just kicks this whole thing into action. Because the question could be asked, you have a birth without, in theory, it's the kind of question that Gemara would ask. I don't know if it's possible. Gemara would ask, if you have a birth without any blood, do you still have, does all that stuff kick in? The answer is yes, it does. So So I think it's different. It's not totally unrelated, but it's different.
Right.
Yes.
There's a difference between the customs of mourning than the legal status. So God forbid someone kills someone, and that's an adult, or that's one that's within the first 30 days of life. Is there any difference?
No, there's no difference.
So
the reality is there's an additional, in medical ethics, there's another category that's relevant. It's probably relevant. It's the category of trefa.
What?
Trefa.
Not
kosher. Oh, trefa. And it's trefa. It's het, resh, pe, aleph in the Aramaic. Trefa. Question of trefa is, if somebody is dying, let's say, as a question, if a person was dying, and then somebody kills him, is that a murder? Is that a murder? Right, that's the question. On this, people today are killing each other. I mean, because is there room for euthanasia?
No.
Okay? This is where you would go from here to say, is there any analogy between this and a fact pattern that we could describe as a permissible pattern of euthanasia? Okay? So that's a slightly different situation. Slightly different. And it doesn't apply. The first 30 days are not dealt with as times of trefa.
So there is no difference whatsoever.
Correct. Once there's a birth.
I think that's really the more important principle then with regard to the moral status of the child. Here we're talking about a custom that has other dimensions, and the fact that so many young children probably did die, and the impact on being in shiva multiple times, and a lot of other things that might be playing in here. But I think from the standpoint of establishing the moral structure of...
Absolutely.
And you know, the argument there would be, and that's why the viability aspect is, I think, is really complex, because the minute you raise the question as to intrinsic viability, then you leave open the question of the murder for exactly the reason that you said, because then you may not be able to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the murder, and in fact not just a loss of viability intrinsically. But the fact that the moral status is
so
life affirming
here
from the minute of birth, I think is really the paramount.
Correct. I agree with you absolutely 100%, and I think that that's the correct conclusion to be drawn from this on the ethical level. I was simply trying to introduce these time frames from the fact that as far as the relationship goes, and the laws of mourning are really triggered by issues of relationships, I would like to argue. I think that that's really the key issue to my mind, because you're dealing with consoling mourners. Right? We're not so much dealing with the dead as we are with the living.
Right.
And with the living, we are dealing with the reality of how they are responding after the loss. Okay, more questions, Harry?
No, I was. You pointed out to me in answer to a question that I had that the high rate of infant mortality at that time created a different attitude towards that kind of death than it is today when people have two or three or
correct. So just to take off from that, just I want to make one statement about that. It puts that is why there is so much discussion on this issue today. Because the question is, because the medical realities have changed, and as a result of that, the relational realities have changed, should the law change? Or should one learn from the law something that one brings into one's relation to birth and to the problems sometimes associated with birth? It could go in one direction, it could go in the other direction. Maybe in a case like this, the traditionalist would argue that we need to be aware of these things because we should, in dealing with young people, for example, our society should develop in them a sensitivity not to make certain assumptions, not to do that. Most of us are afraid to discuss things like that, let's say with our children. You really don't want to raise issues like that. In a way, you want the society, you want the general discussions to just breed a certain level of consciousness about these things, so that in fact you don't have to raise the subject. It's a subject you don't want to raise when you're dealing with people who are close to you. It's too distressing, distressful. So you could go in one direction, you can go in the other direction, and that's where a lot of discussion is going on these days.
Does the 30-day window also represent something to be to the woman giving birth? Is there any discussion in the Talmud of the concept of postpartum depression, of course not given those names, but that the 30 days is also incorporating that concept, because it then would allow the mother to have a little bit of removal.
Mm-hmm.
It might be their, if I would say, their attempt to cope with postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm. Interesting thought. I can't offhand quote sources about postpartum depression, but I think you do have things like this. You do have things that could be interpreted as being responsive to that. And this too, then, if one wonders, it could be. Because we don't really know, for example, how babies were handled right after birth. I mean, we make the assumption that a mother nursed the infant. I don't know that that's necessarily a valid assumption. Or even that a mother was full-time with an infant, even if a mother was to nurse an infant. There are a variety of possibilities. Surely in the Torah. In the Torah, the sense is that you have a wet nurse. Why are each of the mothers of the people given a nurse, a woman that goes together with them? In all likelihood, it's probably a wet nurse. And these women function as nurses for the babies. So, you know, that's a possibility. In Israel today, it's fascinating. After a woman gives birth, some parts in the Haredi parts of the community, sometimes the woman goes, generally it's with the baby as far as I know, but the woman goes away to a hotel. She gets a paid vacation after the birth, because if you have 10 kids at home and you come home with an 11th kid, you can't take care of the child. It's an impossible situation for a woman. So that the community has developed leave for mothers. Mothers leave. It's fascinating. This is the function of the Haredi community today in Israel. So I don't think we should assume the simplest of all possibilities. There are really other possibilities, and they may take into account the emotional state of the mother. Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, you're above.
There have been like letters from colonial women writing to friends saying, warning them not to get too attached to the child because they lose so many children, and there was this kind of camaraderie among women. But that's because the natural tendency was that they were attached, even though they knew that the reality was that a percentage of their children, a large percentage,
was children.
So I think, I don't know about the men's, you know, attachment or non-attachment through this very early period, but I do think that women have chemically an attachment that builds up over 9 months and immediately afterwards.
Absolutely.
So that regardless of technology, they were attached.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, I think it's absolutely true. Although, as you say, if you have letters like that from the colonial period, women were conscious of these kinds of problems and talk to each other about those problems. And that's kind of reflected here. interesting that there is no separation, no assumption of any difference between men and women as far as the law goes. The Jewish law deals with them, as in all the laws of mourning, exactly the same.
I have just two questions. When did Caesareans begin? I'm, you know, interested.
Certainly before Caesar.
You're right, exactly. So, I mean, when does it count? Right, that, or even before that?
Because it's in the Talmud. The Talmud's full of it. If you say in Hebrew, it's a Talmudic phrase, Yotze Dofen,
right.
Which means out of the wall, coming out of the wall. Dofen is a wall.
So when was the count, the counting by law would be on the basis of a natural birth, I would think, and maybe not a cesarean or the child being ripped from the womb, you know, that mm-hmm. type of thing. And the other thing is that during the first few days of nursing, that's a very important period. The mother's milk is quite different, and it's called, I think, colostrum, or it carries with it antibiotics that help the child survive. And I would think that, you know, the wet nurse would maybe come in 3 or 4 days afterwards, but at least the mother would give the first few days of milk. And I don't know whether if a child is born by cesarean, when the mother, the hormonal change occurs, when the mother begins to elaborate antibiotic resistance within the milk.
It's
a very complicated.
I'm sure it is.
It's not there. The question: when do you start counting? You know.
You count from the time of birth.
I mean, if they're not.
Doesn't matter how you come out. Once you're out, you're out.
You're out.
It's a question of variation in definition of the sanctity of life. Is it halachic or rabbinic, the origin?
Well, there wouldn't be a difference if it was rabbinic, it would be halachic. Right? So it's a legal definition as far as these things go. But again, you want to see what the parameters of the legal definition are. You can't take them anywhere you want.
Is it scriptural or is it?
Oh, is it scriptural or rabbinic? This is rabbinic.
It's rabbinic. But what about what emerges from what happens when they help you injure a pregnant woman and kill the baby?
Oh, that of course is scriptural. Yes. Oh, if we're talking about the laws of abortion, that's biblical. That's biblical. This is a different situation, I think. This is the birth. This is the neonate after having been born. And the question of the viability has to do with the laws of mourning. And as we've said several times, the laws of mourning are not in the Bible either. The laws of mourning are rabbinic. Here you see another aspect of that.
When did they name the baby? Was it after 30 days? Was this unnamed?
No, I would assume that the infant could be unnamed, but the issue would be, as far as I know, the law is the way it is today. Surely it is as far as male babies go, and I know less about the female babies. The male babies are the Brit Milah. So that, of course, you could have a case where the baby dies before the Brit Milah, in which case that would be an issue, and that is an issue till today. It's still an issue. And the general issue of naming, naming the stillborn. We've had that in Or Zarua several times. Mm-hmm. We've had stillborn babies, and in each case, we have faced the question. It's been very interesting to talk this out with the parents about whether to name the stillborn. And you don't know it, but once in a while you'll hear a prayer said with a name, and the name, in fact, happens to me. I've been involved in this. I know that they're saying it for a stillborn. This happens once in a while. Some parents decide exactly the opposite. And this is because we're in this, we are where we are today. Some parents go absolutely in one direction, some go in absolutely the other direction. Naturally, I tend to be somewhere in the middle, That's just
surprise.
Surprise, surprise. But for people in the middle, then there's only one person left in the middle, I think, as far as the middle goes. Joe Lieberman is the only one on that side. I'm the only one on the rabbi side. So, happens to be everybody abandoned in the middle. It's kind of lonely, but what are you going to do? But that's very interesting to see what happens, that people really, and it's not as, my experience has not been that people are all modern, let's say. I've had exactly the opposite experience in Oz Arura. I would say more often than not, the Oz Arura experience tends to be on the small c conservative side, which I think is vastly different than if this congregation were pushed over to the other side of town. It's vastly different. So usually the argument is much more more conservative. More people are very sympathetic to what we're reading here in the Gemara and would usually themselves end up making this argument without any knowledge of the text. They start there. Not always, but very frequently this has been the case.
The idea of the first 30 days being a kind of suspended animation is to protect the parents against emotional upheaval, which might be, or is it to protect the community against the need to console constantly consoling the parents, or both? Because it seems like
my hunch is both. I think you're right on both scores. I think logic would go in both those directions. I mean, even let's take the text. Let's go on with the text. See what happened. I told you when you got into this Baraita, you just get into the Baraita, you go to a whole other world. You don't exactly remember where we started this evening. We got into another subject.
I have one question.
One more question.
Because it seems that there is this modern sensibility, though, about viability when a couple gets, you know, pregnant, that they don't announce it right away. They wait a certain amount of time because there's this possibility you could have miscarriage.
Or it's the possibility of wanting to abort if they find out certain things about the fetus. And that's, I think, an important piece of what's going on in... I'm not saying that what you're saying is not true. I think that plus what I'm saying together provides the mental state of things.
But is there an actual, is it just custom when people announce it, or is there actually some...
Oh, there's nothing in the religious law at all.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there may be in the general populace, I don't know what those rules are, but there's nothing in the religious law at all about such an announcement. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now back to the bright. Kol shloshim yom tinok yoseh b'chek. Now, during the 30 days, the infant goes out the chayk. What that means is that to bury the infant, we don't get involved in the formalities of a formal funeral, as it were. We don't get involved in the appurtenances of that. I mean, to us it seems a little bit odd, and it is odd, but realize to them, as to the Israelis today, the Israelis don't use a coffin. Right? You don't use a coffin. So to us, even that seems very odd, because we can't imagine not using a coffin. The Israelis are the opposite from us, and they're normal, by and large. So here, you take the infant out, the chek, without any of the specialized kinds of carriages.
You're hugging.
You basically you take the infant to the breast and you walk them out, walk the infant out and you bury it. Okay?
Is the body prepared?
Of the infant? No.
No.
The infant is not. Vinikbar vinikbar b'isha achat u'shnei anashim. Now, what this is saying is that when it comes to the actual burial itself, it can be done, again, informally, by very few people. The assumption is that in a normal funeral, there are many who are involved. But here, we're assuming that there are a minimum number of people. and that these people are by themselves. That is what gives, that is the source of this, at the undercurrent here. The undercurrent of Nigbar b'isha achad u'shnei nashim, one woman and two men, or two men and one woman, there the issue is an issue of tzniut, of modesty, or of the temptation of being alone with women, that when one is alone with women, that a situation, that is, it's not a desirable, because one's sexual desires will be stimulated, and therefore one avoids those circumstances. Okay? Two men with one woman, one woman was permissible, the assumption being that each man will be realize the other guy is watching him. Okay, this is a man-centered text here, right? The men are worried about men, not for no reason. Although the comment here immediately is Abba Shaul says, "Afi isha achad u'shnei nashim." What are you talking about? This is a burial.
Yeah.
I mean, who's cruising in a burial? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, we had a precedent 2 weeks ago with a man who has no children,
right,
looking around the graveyard to find his next wife.
Sure.
A man who has young children and looking around. I mean, I think that
you happen to be correct. You happen to be correct. When you're dealing with the world, today's Israeli newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, for example, today, has an article. On the front page, I think this is Yiddish, I don't think it was the American paper. I don't know which paper it was. I think it was on the internet. And I sometimes get to see these news flashes on the internet. A woman, her husband died. What was this article? Her husband died. And she went shopping.
Yeah, it was on the internet. It was a Marine.
So tell us, what was the article?
No, she killed him for the
cyanide. She killed him for the
cyanide. That's
an old story. That's now coming to the public.
Because she spent all the money already.
She spent all the money already.
Oh, but
not only that, but she also killed him, so then it makes sense.
Yeah.
Oh, it makes perfect
sense. No, the story was that she spent the money.
Are they testing? Oh, so did she? Yeah. This is normal.
We always know that. It's trying to make sense.
The question of the two men is not due to witnesses.
It is in a way. Well, it's not. It's not really witnesses. Yeah, but it's not really witnesses, because here you wouldn't have two witnesses, because if one of them were culpable, he couldn't be a witness. So you'd only have one witness.
No, but the mother is involved because she's the mother of the baby, and that's too emotionally, she cannot be tested as a witness. Let's say.
She couldn't be a witness anyway, because in the rabbinic law, a woman can't be a witness.
A witness for what? The burial?
Yeah. I don't know, because it's
criminally...
For the adultery.
The inappropriate behavior?
Yeah.
Adultery? I don't think you've got two witnesses for adultery. You only have one witness. Okay, that's the problem. You only have one witness. I mean, one witness here. So I think that before we get hung up on this, Abba Shaul is right. Don't.
You know, this.
The Einom Dima La Beshura. Einom Dima La Beshura, that's part of our morning customs. After you finish the burial, those of you who have been present in a traditional burial know that the people who are there who are not the mourners line up in two rows. One row, two rows, our custom is to do with two rows. And the mourners then walk past the other people, and the other people console them, because that's the beginning of Shiva. Shiva begins after the burial is complete, and then people begin to console the mourners. That is the beginning of Nichum Avelim, the consolation of mourners.
It's interesting, the note 2 here puts it the other way. It says people form a row and file past the mourner. I've never seen that.
That is a way that it was done in the Talmud. That is the way. We do not do that. We do not do that. We do it the opposite way.
But that's the custom, not the law.
Yeah. I mean, that's to make the line, some make the line, and depends on who's on the line. Or whether the line is moving or stable.
It's the frame of reference.
Yeah.
Relativity.
Correct. Ve'eno mi malad birkat adelim v'tanchumei adelim. For this child in the first 30 days, the infant, one doesn't say the birkat adelim. There was apparently a blessing that was said in the time of the Talmud, which we do not say anymore. We do not say it anymore. Rashi makes mention of it in Masachet Ketubot. It goes like this. Baruch menachem adelim. So that was a blessing that was said.
Exactly.
It falls. Blessed is he. It's probably Baruch Atah Hashem Menachem Avelim. Blessed is he who comforts mourners.
Oh, so that was a blessing for the people who were there.
Yes.
That was a blessing that one would say when seeing mourners. Right. That's a blessing you would say when seeing mourners. Correct. That's the people who are comforting them, because it is about the comforter of mourners who is not the people, but God. Okay? God is the Menachem Avelim. So here you are trying to comfort mourners, but you are saying, blessed is he who is the real source of comfort, who is the Lord who comforts mourners. V'tanchumei Avelim. Eino min tanchumei Avelim. You don't say the phrases that you would say, like Amakom Yonachem Etchem, the variety of language that we use to comfort the mourners. That is to say, now we are really just giving you a variety of facts to say that that family does not observe Shiva. They are not observing Shiva. Okay? Ben Shloshim. Oh, well, let's just sit on that for a minute. And that's the law till today, by the way. What we do, and we've had this in Orzorua, I will say to the family, everybody, and it's interesting, the people have always said to me, they've always said, well, of course, it doesn't make sense to have Shiva. I mean, their reaction has always been, I understand, that makes sense. And then I say, but there's nothing wrong with you deciding that you would like to have people come to console you, just to be with you. To be with you. Some people say, I don't want to see anybody. Some people say, it's great. We'll do it for 2 days. Please make an announcement. And I've had both of those said, you know, without a heartbeat, in a heartbeat, they've known exactly what they wanted. So the real issue here is not an issue of Shiva, but an issue of what is best for the people. You can see that really what is assumed here is probably nothing. Nothing is probably the assumption behind this. But I don't think that it's an absolute thing. But what has happened is very interesting today, too. There's a lot of literature out there creating sometimes an entire Shiva, and an entire liturgy to be recited particularly by women who are in this position. And some people are very for that. They think it's the most important thing in the world. Other people are very against it. Think it's the worst thing in the world. So, but this is where a lot of conversation is going on today on just these issues.
What about the grave itself? Does it have to be unmarked?
No, the grave is marked. The grave is marked.
And you need a name. Could it have a matzeva?
In theory, you could say baby. I mean, you could do that.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. Does it have to have a matzeva?
Could you put it?
Yes, you could put a matzeva there.
What is that? Chant?
A stone. You can or you can't. It depends. People will do both. You don't have to. People
well,
will do
we
both.
Have friends. He was in medical school in Switzerland. He was married, and they had a baby, and died after two days. The rabbi told them they couldn't mark the grave with
a... Correct. There are different customs here.
Stingy, that's
this, there are, realize what the issue is, and I've seen it happen in both these cases now.
Yeah.
When you go, let's say you have a baby who dies in the first few days. I've found that in subsequent births, the parents have to decide the extent to which they want to, number one, reveal, number two, discuss in detail the earlier things with subsequent children. Is this something that you are helping your children if you talk to your children about this, or are you hurting your children if you talk to them? Because children like to know a lot of things. And, you know, do you do this at an early age, do you do it at a late age? If you have a stone, that frequently will force the issue in certain circumstances, because it's natural, there'll be something there, and there, you're just increasing the reasons to have that conversation. People are more likely to have that conversation, and parents are not always sure they want to have that conversation with their other children, or that they want it forced on them. They want to control it. When and if they have that conversation, they want to be in charge. And you lose that charge if you have a stone there, or you might lose that charge. Yes.
This prayer that they used to say that Blessed he is the source of comfort, to me in ways is as jarring or more so than Blessed is Hashem, the true judge.
Well, that may be why we don't say it anymore.
I'm wondering if that is.
It's not really not explicitly. It's nowhere here in this Masechet. It's nowhere in Masechet Brachot. So one wonders the extent to which it actually was said. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't know for the commentator.
Saying it sometime after the burial, you know, a few days, but right at that moment.
What I see when I read this, my understanding of it is not the way the commentators understand it, but I think I'm wrong. My understanding is we do say a blessing when we make kriya. That's what we say. So when I read this, I assumed that's what they were talking about. You read the commentators and you see they're not talking about that. That's not the issue. As far as I can see, it's not the issue there. And I don't know what the source or the history is of Dayan HaEmet. That's what we say, and that's what I assume was being discussed here. But as far as I can see, that's not what the commentators are referring to. Okay? A little bit further. Ben Shloshim Yotze Bidluskama, 30-day-old. Now, once you get a 30-day-old, then the laws of mourning fall. Once you have that, it's taken out of the luskama, whatever that is, the box. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo the luskama hanitelet pekatef, not in a box that's carried on the shoulders, right? But one that's nitelet the agapayim, one that's carried in the arms. So, in other words, it's still there's a nice sense to that, that it's close. There's a closeness to it. Still a baby. The omdim alav b'shura, and they stand in a row. That is to say that now mourning actually happens. There's formal mourning once we get to 30 days. The omrim alav birkat avelim v'tanchumei avelim. And all these other pieces of mourning are part of it. Ben shneimasar chodesh yotze b'mita. And finally, when you're dealing with a year old, the child is treated more or less as someone larger, you know, as a regular person. He goes out in a bier. And Rabbi Akiva then says, it's really a two-year-old that we're talking about. Any other Yoseba mita rabim masidim alav. If a child is taken out in the bier, the public grieves over him. If he does not go out in the bier, the public does not grieve over him. All I can tell you is that I think I know what this means. And it's really a terrible thing. There is a point at which you have a public funeral. There is a point when you don't. I've been with families to the cemetery where only the very immediate family comes. It's most common for these very early deaths. But time is the factor here. As time goes on, the child becomes a person in the eyes of the community. And that's the reality. And when you are at that particular point where the community, that the child is a real person to others, then you have a public funeral. You have a public funeral. And it seems like the appropriate thing to do. In all of my funerals that I've officiated, hundreds probably, the most horrendous is when you walk down an aisle. It's usually the large room at Riverside. I've always been around by here in Manhattan. When you walk down the large room, a long aisle down that large room in the Riverside Chapel. Why in the large room? Because when you have a funeral like this, you fill a large room. Everybody comes. I was so filled with grief. And I remember when, unfortunately, this happened, I've been rabbi a number of times. Walk down. As you pass the people break up, and people just go to pieces. And it's just a terrible experience. It's just one of the worst things that you ever lived through. But that's what I think it means here. That's what he's talking about. That's the Rabbi Matzibim Pneihem. Okay? They are distraught. Matzibim Panav, literally, the faces get yellow. The faces get yellow. Basically, people, they collapse from this. I mean, it's just something that people, regular people, just react to with absolutely distraught. That's the most, just the greatest grief I've ever witnessed has been at public funerals of that nature. On that happy note, my friend. You should have many good things during the next week. Okay. The simcha.
What if a child that appears as a 2-year-old and is a 1-year-old, or is a 1-year-old and appears as a 2-year-old?